Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I am your host, Brandy Miller, and as we continue our series on purity culture, I'm really, really excited to get to offer this conversation with Dr. Hillary McBride, registered psychologist. We talk about desire and the ways that desire is formed, framed, and engaged within Christian spaces, and the ways that science and psychology can help us to move back toward holistic being and ourselves. My hope in conversations like these is always to rectify the ways that purity culture has deprived many of us of education and of our natural development as people. I so love that Dr. Hillary McBride gives us opportunities to do so, and I'm so grateful to get to offer this conversation. And with all of that, please enjoy this episode with Dr. Hillary McBride. Thank you so much for this time. I'm really grateful to get to have you on Reclaiming My Theology as we're continuing what feels like a never-ending expression of purity culture and figuring out how do we not just do the kind of deconstruction thing around it, but actually rebuild sexual and sensual lives in religious contexts that are meaningful to us. And I'm so grateful to have you be a voice as we engage with some of these issues.
Thank you for having me. I just felt so excited even hearing you say that. Like, this rebuilding of our sensual and sexual lives feels like such a valuable effort. So I'm glad you're taking all the time with the series.
We really are. That cannot be overstated at this point. It's been like well over a year at this point.
You know, there's almost something kind of erotic in saying that. There's a song, gosh, Ashley Ball is an artist, and she has a song in one of the lines in the songs it's off her recent album. It says, "I love it when you take your time," and there's something incredibly sensual about it. I think the song is about lovers, and it just hit me right as you were saying it, as I was saying it back to you, like, oh, there's something in this, like, taking time with something, slowing it down, takes us out of our dissociated ways of interacting with things as just ideas, but like thickens into the embodied experience, into the sensuality of something. Like, I'm just picturing eating like a ripe piece of fruit and letting the juice dribble down my chin and savoring it, and how erotic that can be. And I'm imagining you doing that ironically with purity culture content. You're like, I'm just sinking my teeth into this juicy fruit and this rebuilding. So good.
We're really trying our best to make space for people to feel this process fully, to engage fully, to not be, even as you're saying, rush through their own process of, because, you know, we can't rush healing or generative processes in general. And so with purity culture, we have felt like, while we've done these series that are super important to me on white supremacy, patriarchy, and all of these other things, purity culture hits this particular intersection of all of them.
It does.
In a way that is requiring a re-embodiment or a reconnection with our bodies in a way that feels meaningful. And so I'm glad to have you on here. And as a person engaging with how people relate to their own bodies and their own personhood, I always ask folks who come on one question to get to know them a little bit. And so, Hillary, I would love to know, in this season, what does it mean to be you?
Well, I think that I'm coming into the time sequencing. It feels strange to think about, but I'm in a process of grief and trauma processing after a series of I had a twin miscarriage and a medical trauma related to a procedure after that. And I'm in the season of like, wow, okay, that feels still pretty fresh. And to me right now, I feel connected to the tenderness and proximity of life and death and as it relates to other people, my own. And so right now I feel myself in that space, operating right in the liminality of like, oh, it's pretty miraculous that we're here. And and to be me right now in this moment feels like I'm constantly touching the edges of life, death, awe, grief, and all of the spaces that live in that particular pocket. Yeah.
And what a vulnerable place to be.
Mm-hmm. What an vulnerability,
exposing.
Yeah, and I love the exposure too. Like, what I feel like it exposes me to is beauty, and it exposes me to sacredness of aliveness and the miracle of it. I did for Lent last year. It was 2023. I did 40 days of death meditations as a way of, what I was giving up was denial of death. What I was giving up was the avoidance
interrupting.
Yeah. And interestingly, that what I found at the end of those 40 days was I saw so much beauty around me. It was like a strange, bizarre thing to go out into the garden in my backyard and see colors with more vibrancy in a way that it's almost like the edge between beauty and death started to blur a little bit. And I know that that's a tender thing to say, and that's not how everyone feels about it. And talking about death can be really evocative, and even the way I'm talking about it might feel provocative in some way. And so I'm not trying to make claims about other people, but for me, that was an experience that I had. And I realized that I feel, right back in that particular pocket again, after some of these experiences at the end of last year.
Well, I so appreciate you bringing that to this space. And even I think about some of my friends who do essentially like death doula work. So hospice care, other types of end of life care, dying with dignity care, in the ways that they talk often about becoming at home with their own deaths or their own mortality in a way that even pulls from kind of this Lenten stuff that is just like, well, you're dirt and you're going to return to it. So like, do better, instead saying, what does it mean to live into that word that you said, sacredness of our own life, the fragility of it all, and in our own well-being. And that feels so significant and tender. And I think for folks who are in a Lenten journey right now, we're like a little over halfway through, and it's just a tender space to be, to hold any season for a length of time with intention. And so I'm grateful that even as people are doing the purity culture work and figuring out what spirituality is or is not to them, and are doing all of those things, that there are these intersecting points of, I mean, we're aiming for sacredness and connection and belonging, and that all of those things tie together. And so I'm grateful for that in your description of your own, what sounds like a very painful and challenging season, both physically and emotionally, really in a holistic way.
Yeah.
And so not to make too hard of a pivot in that way, but I think as we're in this season, I'm also trying to get a little bit of a sense of people's history with purity culture. Where has that intersected with your life or work in some way?
Yeah. You know, I think growing up in an evangelical context, also in Canada, evangelical context, I think we were just a little more watered down than it was. As I'm learning, as I have more contact with folks who grew up in evangelicalism in the States, there's this whole other angle around nationalism and patriotism and kind of the state involvement. And in a way that I just didn't experience here, it felt like purity culture light, so to speak. But yeah, that was definitely something that was around me and that I was steeped in. And I think my favorite way to talk about it would be in terms of parts of me, that there was a part of me that was deeply embedded in purity culture and felt like it was a way to be good in the eyes of a community that I knew I wanted approval from. And then there was also another part of me that was like, I am a sexual being and I love my sexual exploration. And I think that for me, a conflict that I carried with me up into a certain point was how to reconcile that I really wanted to be good in the eyes of a community, that in order to behave in that way, it would fragment me from my burgeoning sexuality that I think is a totally developmentally healthy and normal and appropriate season of adolescence, young adulthood, even childhood to some degrees, like knowing our bodies, exploring our bodies, feeling pleasure in our bodies as we grow up is such a good and healthy and right thing. And so the way that I could conceptualize this is like, I think I felt a lot of conflict internally because I didn't completely lean into one of those parts. I was juggling the tension.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think describes many of our experiences, the experiences that I've been hearing from folks. And part of what I think feels particularly challenging in that is that when an individual is in conflict in the midst of power structures, it's really hard to let the most personal side of that take up more space. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of folks that I've been talking to in that conflict have chosen or have been pushed into, in some ways, I don't even know the right verbiage for it really, to repression, to disembodiment, to shame and into guilt, rather than recognizing what you're saying, these developmentally appropriate explorations and expressions of self in ways that I think particularly in evangelical Christian spaces are challenging when disembodiment is a core tenet of what it means to exist in that community.
Mm-hmm. Hearing you say that, I'm just reflecting that my reaction to that in that pause was, wow, I'm feeling so grateful that I had the educational environment that I did, particularly university and my career, my chosen field here, in terms of helping me understand in a non-purity culture informed way, like, what are developmental needs? What do we need as people? And to really be like, whoa, I kind of got like a skewed perspective of that when I was handed some stories from a very like the very specific kind of narrative of development that were handled that I think perpetuates a kind of fragmented self, like a disembodied self that somehow, fortunately, because of my training and my career, I got access to what we would call, you know, air quotes, a more secular perspective of development, which, yeah, I think really rounded out the ideas about bodies that I had coming into my higher education.
Which does feel like a significant gift. I feel like many folks that I'm talking to, especially folks who are like late in life queers or folks who are trying to figure out these things in this iteration of life, are like, oh my gosh, there's so much information I didn't know. Where do you start? And then how do I both unlearn the kind of triggering I've been taught to feel around people being like, exploration of your body is normal, and being like, and it's normal. And so you have to deal with both the emotional implications of that.
That's right.
And it never makes room for some of what we are going to talk about today a little bit, which is desire. Because I think that in that disembodiment, in the conflict that you're describing, in a lot of the places where we find ourselves in spiritual communities, desire is always subjugated underneath things like obedience or doctrine or theology. And even that idea, as you're talking about needs, that the only thing you need is Jesus. Whatever that means. I feel like the more I'm engaging with this stuff, more I'm like, what did they mean by that? Like, when they said, all you need is Jesus or all you need is God, I can't now logic out what that meant. But what it did do.
Sentence stopping, thought stopping responses that don't really. Yeah, I'm like, what does that mean? But it's we're just supposed to go, and then like, there's. You're right. But what does that mean? Please continue. I'm agreeing with you emphatically.
Well, and then the only things that you can want are things that you find explicitly on the pages of the Bible or in some kind of inherited orthodoxy or idea of right belief or orthopraxy, like right practice. And so I think it is only in my adult life that I've been able to ask, what do I want? What do I like? How do I engage with desire in a way that doesn't just say, the flesh is deceitful or the heart is deceitful above all things. And like, who can know the ways of God? And so you just obey because that's the way that you stay holy or in sacred space with God. And so I would love if you could, because I think that for many of us, we talk about desire. We use the word often, but it's kind of like the word romance. We say it, it feels a little bit like vibes, but it doesn't actually have a lot of legs to it in many of our lives. And so I think desire can be a similar thing. So can you describe for us what even is desire?
I'd love to tell you. And you know, I want to go back in time and offer a segue between the death conversation and the desire conversation, because one of the things that interestingly prompted me to think about denial of death and giving that up as part of my Lenten journey last year is that my word for the year, I had two words for the year, one of them was eros. And so my desire for the year was like, I want to really investigate the erotic. I want to understand what that means. I want to be in contact with that, what that means. And as I was starting to dig into eroticism, eros, like kind of what does that mean? Really, like in terms of this conversation, what does that mean? What does that mean? The history of the word? What are the ways that gets expressed? What's my experience of that? Where the, you know, the areas, the gray areas with that, how does that intersect with all different forms of identity for me? And what I learned is that eros, really at its core, when we look at it from a depth psychology perspective, is like life force energy. It's the something inside of us that propels us forward into fullness, into aliveness, into vitality, into flourishing, right? Even what you could say, if we were being a little tongue in cheek, is like, living life to the full, a la, you know, first century mystic who, who we're kind of talking around in the background here, that there is this actually something very Christ-like about the erotic, in that what we're doing when we are connected to the erotic, when it is moving through us, is that we're expanding, right? We're expanding ourselves, and there are an infinite number of ways to expand ourselves, but it's the thing, at least as I've come to understand it, that moves us, that drives us forward. It's the life force energy that's moving through. So we'll just keep that in the background as we're talking about desire here. And I want to back up again with desire and talk about it in terms of the way that I understand it theoretically, to kind of situate this conversation in the context of psychobiology, really, and developmental neuroscience, which we might not necessarily think of when we are having a conversation about desire. Like, oh, might feel a little clunky inside of us, because we want desire to be like you said, like vibes. We want it to be like even hard to put language on it, but some sort of like have a fluid movement, and it's kind of an animal on its own that can't be contained within the confines of theory. But leave it to me to disrupt
that. Yourself.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. Like, let's put language and theory around this. So when we back up a little bit, what we understand is that there are these fundamental motivating forces in the human experience, and we would call them affect, or sometimes what we colloquially talk about in our culture as emotion, are these mobilizing forces inside of our body that have a few functions. And Jak Panksepp, who's a really famous author on this topic, he's a neurobiologist, like he's written extensively about affect and evolution and development. What he says is that emotions are ancestral tools for living. There are these things that autonomically our bodies like use to move us into life, to support our aliveness. So emotions or affect are bodily processes that have a few different functions. One of them is safety, for sure. One of them is protection, right, which goes along with safety. Connection is another one. And flourishing is the last one. So when we look at affect and those being the primary goals, what I'm talking about when it comes to core affects would be things that we would label like sadness, fear, disgust, excitement, joy, anger, and ding, 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 arousal and desire. When you think about, again, what are these primary motivations of affect? They are to safety, protection, connection, and flourishing. That actually are the net positive of the homeostatic drive in our bodies, is so that we have a surplus of energy. We're not actually meant, when we think about the ways that our systems stabilize and how we've evolved as people, our bodies are not actually just meant to have neutral. When our needs are met, when we're protected, when we're connected, when we have, like, when we're tended to, when we get everything that we need as people, we're actually meant to have more than enough energy so that as a species, we expand, we grow, we create more of this, and this is more of ourselves, and this is actually a fundamental drive written into nature. The same thing that you see in the oak tree that grows acorns, to drop the acorns that get carried along by the wind to plant another tree, that's the same life expanding mechanism that we're talking about that's inside of us. So what is it inside of the tree that allows it to grow and make the acorn and drop the acorn, and not see that as anything except its natural process of flourishing in the world? The same thing that's in that tree is in us. And what I would call that is desire. Desire is that instinctual thing that propels us to actually be satisfied, to have more of ourselves in the world, and to orient us towards what feels good, because what feels good is actually part, what I would say is like part of God's plan of expanding God's self in the world. So the listening to that desire and the moving towards what we desire doesn't mean that we run around and we're like, I want cake. I'm going to steal the cake in the grocery store and I'm going to shove it into my face because this is God's way of being in the world. Like, we don't have to be, in a way, unreflective about what desire is, or disconnect. Like, actual embodiment is the merging of awareness and impulse and sensation, not just like unreflective reactivity. But this, like, this ability to see that inside of ourselves as a something worth following, I think connects us to the larger story of the flourishing of people, that our desires inside of us, especially when we are engaging with them in a reflective way, when we're bringing people into them, not only are they connecting to myself, to who I am, to more of me in the world, but ultimately, like, I think that that when we're actually with core desire and not what we might say with, like, avoidant reactivity, that kind of, like, I want to do that because it gets me away from how painful it is to be alive, which what I would say is, like, kind of different than desire at its core, that when we're connected to core desire, it actually is part of our collective liberation. I think it's actually part of our resistance of systems that disconnect us from our body. I mean, you're hearing Audre Lorde and me talking right now, like, the erotic is the yes to life and aliveness. It's our, like, saying yes to goodness moving into the world through us and allowing ourselves to be conduits to that.
And that is so good. And I'm hearing so many, as you say, Audre Lorde, I'm like, I'm also hearing all these echoes to eco-womanism and the ways that Black women have thought about desire and connection to the earth and, like, what it means to grow a garden and to have a sensual experience of food and of creating life and of seeing those cycles of birth and death. And it's so hard because as you talk about those things, I'm like, yes, like, my body is like, yes to those things. And every time I think about the background that many of us came from, we were taught that desire was something that needed to be suppressed. And so in the language that you're giving us, in suppressing desire, in suppressing desire, we're suppressing our capacity toward personal and collective liberation, which I think would be, like, the mission of Jesus, or, like, the thing that God seems to be talking about in the scriptures. And so it feels ironic to me because it feels very fear-driven, because even as you describe that, what was the phrase you used? Unreflective reaction. I think that unreflective reaction is essentially, like, what I was told that sin was, where it was like, if you are leaning into desire, if you are having sexual exploration in any way, you're just, like, living out your impulse, like, your animalistic urge to have sex. Like, you're just like a lion now, and, like, you're a human. And in the beginning, God created humans to be, you know, more reflective and better and have boundaries on things. And so any kind of even engaging with desire is like this tiptoeing or even maybe cliff falling into sin, because it all gets framed as unreflective reaction rather than a deep connection with self, a core connection with self that I would think would drive core connection with the divine in some way.
Yeah, right. And you would think that. Of course you would think that, because that's right there. Like, I think you have a more complex understanding of what God is doing in the world as it allows us to be in our bodies. But I think that it's a really strategic, manipulative, and abusive strategy to disconnect us from the very thing inside of us that's going to cause us to dismantle power systems that other people benefit from.
Yes.
Right? So it's like, of course they're going to cause us to suppress and disconnect from and inhibit desire, because the desire is going to lead us away from their club, right, that they want to be in charge of.
It's wah, wah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. And this is, like, I think this is connected intimately to anger as well. Like, I'm working I lead group therapy regularly, and in one of my groups we're processing anger as a core emotion. I've been making space for anger, and someone was talking about how anger was the very thing that had to go away in the evangelical faith context that she was a part of. And we were reflecting as a group about how of course the anger had to be put away, because the anger was the thing that was mobilizing her to say that this is wrong. And who wants to hear that if they're benefiting from it and they think it's right? Yes. They want to make that core instinct of this is wrong go away, because then they don't have to look at how their system is hurting people. So, like, right. desire and anger, I think, and ultimately most core emotions, when we're with them in this particular way, are liberatory, because they're connecting us to these core instincts that cause us to disrupt systems that fragment us from ourselves.
Yes. And it makes me think about some messaging that I was given around desire in that, it kind of connected to that, which was, if you love God and if you like fixate, and I mean that in like the most intense kind of maybe pejorative sure. version of that, like if you fixate on spirituality, if you obsess, if you make it your entire worldview, your entire, that it defines in a theological, and I will say biblical in the most heavy air quote sense,
sure,
like evangelical right. definition of right. biblical,
great decision,
that
yeah.
it's, you know, if you love God deeply, God's going to give you the desires of your heart. But the desires of your heart have to be kind of whipped into submission. Right. And I use that violent language really right. intentionally because I think it did feel that way for many of us. And so desire has become very challenging to access because we were told that in following Jesus or something, that there would be a certain type of promise that would be given to us, mm-hmm. that would be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm talking to a lot of people, particularly newly married folks who waited to have sex until they were married, regardless mm-hmm. of their own desire, who are now experiencing a lot of pain during sex, that are experiencing a lot of shame and guilt. And they're like, is this supposed to be what this was? Like, we waited for this particular yeah. visceral feeling in suppression of desire. And so I can hear some of the mm-hmm. the stories of people who have experienced yeah. desire as a particularly suppressed experience while being confused about our desires because we were told that our desires had to be manipulated in order for God to love us. And so I think it's making me think about, one, the additional challenges that spirituality brings in connecting with desire, because I'm certain that people who are not in faith spaces also have challenges connecting to desire because of the culture that we live in. But I think there are additional challenges that mm-hmm. spirituality, particularly kind of culty evangelical spirituality, bring to these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wanted to bring into this piece too. Well, a couple things come to mind as you're saying that. One, just like the grief that I feel about what it's like to be betrayed in that way, to be handed yes. a promise that never gets followed through on, and in fact creates a legacy of wounding. And just yes. how appropriate it is to feel like a healthy grief about very formative years getting stunted or fragmented or you know, right? I'm okay using this word, like being laden with trauma, right? These mm-hmm. injuries, these chronic injuries to self that happen in these faith contexts that cut us off from ourselves, that I just feel inside of me the ache of what it's like to sit across from people who are processing the very real loss of an adolescence, of a childhood, of the exploration of sexuality, of the yes. connection to who they are. I mean, there's this like, these are not just ideas. This is people losing big, big chunks of their life to systems that promised them one thing yes. and now left them unprepared even to deal with the legacy of the wounds that they incurred. So that's part of this, I think I want to name. But the other theoretical piece that I wanted to bring in, which I think is so appropriate in this conversation, is that, okay, if life force energy is desire and it's pushing us towards fulfillment, expression, flourishing, satisfaction, joy, aliveness. And if that's actually like, you know, the tree trying to spring up out of the ground, like mobilizing, building in the spring, reaching towards the sunlight, it's pushing up. That, like, think about the incredible equal opposite force that has to push down to suppress that. Like, what are the mechanisms of that? Well, in psychotherapy, and particularly in the theory that I come from here that I'm using right now, which is AEDP, Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy, that we need these other, like, okay, if I can't stop life force energy from pushing up and make me want things, what am I going to do to shove it down? Well, I'm going to throw my whole weight behind shame, guilt, and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like, those three things tend to be feelings that we use as suppressing tools. So it's no surprise that all sorts of folks who grew up in this context where you're saying, like, my desire is whipped into submission. Well, what is it whipped into submission with? Like, this internalization of this shame narrative that, like, that doesn't go away. And if mobilizing inside of us is desire, and not just sexual desire, as we would, maybe define it within a partnership or with kind of an expression with somebody else or in masturbation behaviors or self-pleasure, whatever. But like, if this is a core affect inside of us that we're trying to suppress, and it's not just about sexuality, but it's about other kinds of wanting, like, what do I want to eat for dinner? And who do I want to be in the world? And where do I want to spend time? And what makes me feel alive? Like, all of those things have to be shut down to get us away from wanting. Yes. And there has to be like an incredible force that we utilize in order to do that. When life is like, I want to flourish. Oh my gosh, there has to be such intense energy resisting that to keep that down.
Yes. And it feels so tragic to me, because it feels like we're given a tool belt of tools to engage with the desire, and all of them are repressive. And so what I'm noticing as I walk with people on this journey toward unlearning purity culture, or reclaiming a theology that has more space, even if that's the minimum we get to, it's just there's a little bit more room. I'd be happy if even that was, you know, like, my bar is low, because the trauma, as you're describing, and the experiential spaces that people have occupied are really, really painful. It's just hard when that's like the only toolkit that we've been given. And what I'm noticing is that when we start to engage with desire, or people are like, I feel like what I'm seeing is people are having a run into like a, fine, I give up. Like, I give up on purity culture. I don't believe it intellectually. I know it's causing something to happen in my body, so I give up. But don't do the desire work outside of sex and sensuality, and then suddenly enter in and into spaces, really intimate spaces, and feel all of that guilt and shame and anxiety, and the lack of tools around consent and responsibility and respect. Mm-hmm. And so have this incredibly painful experience of sex and sensuality with repression in their religious space. And then this whole new world where it says like, oh, well, suddenly you need this, like, you're going to get this incredible sexual fulfillment because you're breaking free of that thing. And we skip just the basic bridge of, how do I know what my body wants? Mm. How do I know what desire feels like? How do I know what wanting is?
Yes.
And it is I'm just seeing a lack of development of those tools.
That's it.
Because it feels easier in some ways, or more practical in some ways, to just go start having sex or having sexual experiences without a lot of reflection around how those things will also impact the body. And not in the way that purity culture says that they will, like in soul ties or whatever things, but just in like, oh, if I don't know what I want, I can't articulate what I want. Yeah. And then I feel unsafe.
Right.
And so I think there's some like practical, just basic pieces that I feel a lot of grief and tenderness around for people.
Right. Yeah. That's so, so beautifully said. Yeah. The developmental skills don't get worked out at the time when it's appropriate for us to be working them out. And I've worked with so many people who are trying to figure out what consent means in their 40. And there's a lot more complication when there's, you know, lives involved, and, you know, maybe even their own children's lives involved, and negotiating with partners, and like the stakes are higher than, you know, perhaps learning at 14 or 12 or 17 or 9 or whatever, like how to hold someone's hand and say, no, I don't want that, or like, that doesn't feel good, or can you do it like this? Or maybe even as a baby, having your no respected, and having being able to learn as a kid, I get to say no, and I get to say yes, and I get to pay attention in those early moments. Like, when I have people around me helping me figure those things out, it's a lot. I would say there are some things that get missed developmentally that absolutely can be learned and made up for. I mean, the beauty of the human experience is that we're inside of time and outside of time, that it's never too late. And right. It's harder sometimes when we're all grown up to figure out things that other people learned when they were younger. But I think that it's really important to recognize that there are development things that get missed.
Yes.
But that's exactly what's happening. Skills, tools, experiences, when we weren't supported and surrounded with other wisdom, with elders saying, hey, have you thought about this? And we're trying to figure it out on our own in our 30s or 40s or 50s or whatever.
Yes. And that the invitations to do that, I think from people who have been trained in evangelical Christianity, can be really hard, because I think that many of us were taught that change needs to be repentance, a 180, like a cutting off of your hand or a plucking out of your eye. Everything like feels extreme because Jesus had to die or something. Like, there's like this really strange reactive process around change. And so I think that many of us, when we're starting to relearn or to, you know, to be parented in some way, or like to grow up in particular ways that we weren't taught, I think those shame responses can come back to like, how do I not know how to do this? Like, how do I not know what I want? How do I not know what I desire? Like, I'm 33 and I can't answer that question clearly. And I've been seeing that happen a lot where I ask people in these contexts, like, well, do you know what you want? And I think I've treated it in a little bit of a cavalier way, acting like it's a simple question. And the more I run into that, the more I run into people, or the more I ask that, the more I run into people who are like, I don't know. And I'm just trying things so I can figure it out. And that also feels bad. And so the whole journey is feeling like a visceral unlearning of both the tools that we were given and the things that we thought we wanted to make space for the things that we might actually want or desire. Yeah. And that whole journey, I just want to acknowledge for folks, is painful and is and can be more gentle. And I think for me, like, some of the practices that you offer even in your book, like training hand massages with a partner and asking for in a second round, like, for what you want in a way that is low stakes. And I think because in Christianity, so many things are high stakes, a lot of our unlearning, I think, has to have a counterbalance of being incredibly low stakes so that it does feel safe and protective and encourages our flourishing and connection. And so I really appreciate some of the ways that you've taken really simple practices, even if they're really, they're simple. Many of them are very, very challenging, I think, and will be challenging for many of us. But pulling things from the high stakes into I get to learn, and that's a really significant gift I think you've given people in this book.
Thank you so much for saying that. That feels good to know. Yeah, I don't assume that remembering ourselves is easy, but I think that it can be simple. Right. And that's a helpful distinction. You know, just as you were saying, like, asking, like, I don't know what I want. Asking someone, what do you want? And them saying that, I just kept thinking, like, I wonder what it's like to name that what you want is something you want. Knowing what you want is something you want is like the starting place. It's like, it's like the seed before it grows into anything else. Like the potential. It's like, I want to know what I want is like, is something. Right. And it probably comes with its a unique physiological signature of like, often wanting comes with some sort of like organizing or solidifying in our core, or even like what's really cool to look at in the neurophysiological literature is there's approach tendencies, what we would call them, you know, officially in the academic language of this, you know, the way that our bodies behaviorally mobilize to pull us towards something comes with nerve ending activation in our front body. Because if you think about it, we want the front of our body and our hands and our arms to be mobilized to draw us into something. And we can look at the opposite of like avoidance tendencies or withdrawal tendencies mobilizing the back half of our body because they pull us away from things. It helps our body like even to move our feet backwards and backpedal. So starting to notice like even when I want to want, do I notice sensation that goes along with that? Of like, oh, right. I could even, when I think about wanting, sometimes we do these things with our mouth. We're like, right. Or our hands. We're like, oh, I want to get my hands on that. Or we feel this like, right. Like someone shows you something or tells you like, I've got something to tell you. And you lean in, you're like, tell me more. Right. Even that feeling of like, I want to know, like that, the, I want to know brings us in. And so even paying attention to little things, like I want to know what it means to want. I want to want, like, would come with some like a longing approach tendency. Maybe we even could be able to feel the beginnings of that in our body, even listening to this conversation here.
And what a lovely invitation that is in the midst of a lot of scripts and narratives that would tell us that even leaning in, even in the language that you're using, is a threat to our spirituality or a threat to our connection with community, which I think that actually is true. Like, I think that sometimes leaning into our desire is a threat to connection with the power systems and structures that have formed us.
Yeah.
But it really is a little bit of the irony as I think about some of the words of Jesus, like gain the world, lose your soul. I'm like, oh man, like the attributes of the world exist in the quote unquote world, exist these power dynamics and structures in our churches. And the thing that we do lose in those spaces is our soul, our core ability to, our core space, our deepest parts that allow us to connect and to be and to be grounded in the only body we'll ever live in, like the home that is our body. And so I can feel the conflict that many of us might have and the loss that we might feel. And I don't want to undercut that because I think that that is true. And there is a necessity to do even some kind of negotiating in ourselves to cost and benefit in the most crass terms of the connections, connective spaces we're in. Mm-hmm. Because I know for me, I've had to distance from particular communities in particular ways, even if I don't neglect them completely, in order to be more whole myself and to engage with some of these questions that we're discussing today.
Yes. Oh, I could listen to you talk about this for a long time. I was like, how about we flip the interview around and I just ask you all sorts of questions about this, because I could listen. I just, there's like so much here, and wow, I feel inspired by the conversation and listening to your analysis about it, and the way that power is relating to all of this feels so astute. Like, thank you for inviting me into this conversation and sharing even your thoughts about it. It feels so, so good to hear.
It's deeply kind of you to say, and I just feel so grateful to get to do it. Like, the thing I say often is I became the accidental pastor of a digital megachurch, and the thing that I know of pastors generally in my life is irresponsibility. And so my hope is to be as responsible in my own personal work, so that I have an embodied experience of what I'm asking people to do, because I think a lot of my experience of spirituality is people being asked to do things that their leaders never did, or being asked to pay costs that their leaders never would, or are being asked to give up things that their leaders have never given up. I think it makes me think about like the stereotype of like the like white male pastor with a smoking hot wife who's then like, hey guys, don't have sex till you're married, and you're like, okay, well, like, you're speaking out of a place that like is not relatable to anybody here, and the only thing that you're promising is that they're gonna have like a hot wife too at the end of it, and there's like no room for queerness, there's no room for anything. And so I think for me, as I'm on this journey and trying to be in conversation with folks like you, I'm trying to offer people more gentle spaces and on-ramps to their own becoming than were offered to them in other spaces.
Well, you're doing it.
Thank you. Well, I want to honor your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
And but I do want people to know where they can find your work. I'm going to do like a little pre-plug, because I've read both of your books, Wisdom of Your Body and then The Embodied Practices. And I so appreciate the justice, I think, that you're doing in this, like actual justice that you're doing in the second book in creating access. I think for many of us, as we try to get to know our bodies and as we try to unlearn, relearn, get in touch with ourselves, the academic can be so prohibitive in our process. And what I found in, which I, you know, and I operate in those spaces. And so your first book was incredibly comfortable for me. And this one has been much harder, because it pulls me out of my brain and into like heart and body space that I'm not like particularly interested in being in all the time. Like, I'm still, as much as I'm trying to do this work, it still takes a lot of intentional effort to disengage from the brain and to be fully in my body. And so I just want to say first, I really appreciate that you created a strong, strong access point for people who want to engage with your work, but who may not be able to, who may not have been able to in a heart way from the first book. So I just want to say thank you for that, because I think, I don't think most academics are able to do that. And it's a profound gift you've given people.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. So with that, what would you like to plug? Where can people find you? Where can the folks find your work and get connected?
So you can find me on social media, Hillary L. McBride or Hillary Leanna McBride. Those are usually the handles that I use. I've got a website, hillarylmcbride.com. But in June of this year, I've got a new season of Other People's Problems coming out. And we're going to be focusing on psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, which will be a little bit of a new angle for folks. So if you want to head to our back catalog and listen to episodes now to get caught up, that's a good idea. And then in spring of 2025, I've got a book on spiritual trauma coming out. So it'll dig into this, looking particularly at the developmental lens, like what gets missed developmentally in contexts where our an infantilized developmental self is valorized in a way that there is this, like, the young mind is seen as somehow spiritually mature, and yet what we're missing out on is kind of the natural progression of the human experience. So that's called Holy Hurt. So that's called Holy Hurt. That's coming out. There's like an 8-part audio series that I did that the book is based off of. And that audio series is called Holy Hurt. And it's on anywhere you can find a podcast. So look that up if you want to get a head start on that material. And working on some more books and projects all the time. So stay tuned. There's all sorts of things coming.
Amazing. Well, hopefully we can wrap back around and have you back when some of those projects are coming to fruition in ways that would feel helpful to partner with. So
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it so much. It's been such a gift to spend some time together.
My pleasure. We'll see you on the other side, wherever that is.
Yes. Thank you for joining for another episode of Reclaiming My Theology. As always, so grateful for all of y'all for listening, for commenting, for rating, reviewing, for following us on socials, and for telling your friends. It goes a long way to helping folks find the show. And really, if you do have 30 seconds and want to give us a review, that does help a ton and takes, basically no time at all. We're also going to be doing an Ask Me Anything soon, including advice and segments where I'll bring on other folks who've been on before to help work through some of the questions that we have lingering as we continue our journey in purity culture. Well, away from purity culture, technically, but y'all know what I mean. So if you have those questions, you can send them by voice memo or by normal text to reclaimingmytheology@gmail.com. We're really, really grateful to get to continue to keep doing this work, even though it's been going on a long time, y'all. But as it intersects with all the other things that we've talked about on the podcast, it feels like a continuing journey to help us to heal and to try to do a little bit better together.